Good morning. It's good to be back together after a weekend of worshiping out there instead of in here. We had a great time. My family did, a beautiful day, and I wanted to start off this morning by just saying thank you to everybody who made Beautiful Day happen. It was a tremendous weekend. This event is one of the great examples of our church doing stuff where the staff really does almost nothing for this event. And all the good stuff that happens is you guys rolling up sleeves and volunteering. And it's kind of from my position of seeing people come together and seeing people volunteer and step up, it's amazing to see what we can accomplish and the work that we can do. So it was a fun weekend. We enjoyed it. Thanks to everybody that participated. Well, that was about this time of year. I was graduating high school, and I was applying for my first summer job. A family friend knew the hiring manager at a local sporting goods store named Oshman's, and so I went in and I did my interview, and I kind of gave my best pitch, and I went home, and I waited by the phone. You know, that was when phones were tied to the wall. So I was there waiting. The hiring manager, his name, I still remember, was Charles Prince. Not to be confused with Prince Charles, but I remember it because I'd been in his office for the interview, and I just had this vision in my head. I could see him getting up from his chair, picking up the phone, dialing my number, and calling me with the good news. And I was just waiting for that moment. I had done all I could do. I'd interviewed, I'd given my best version of myself, and it was now out of my hands, out of my control, to wait and see how things would turn out. What do you do when you've done all you can do? When your fate lies out of your hands? What do you do while you're waiting? How do you deal with that sense of being out of control? Decisions being made about your life that you can no longer influence? Well, we're back together, as Jake mentioned, in the life of David. We're in the home stretch of this series that we've called A Life of Passion, working our way through all of the ups and downs of David's life. Most recently, we've seen David make a series of tragic and abusive mistakes. We've seen the consequences of those mistakes play out in his family dynamics, and in response, we've seen David do nothing. He's become passive. He's let stuff happen, and he hasn't seemed to know what to do in response. Until 2 weeks ago, when we saw David's son Absalom rise up against him and rebel and make a play for the throne itself. And when that happened, David snapped into action, he gathered his people, and in a surprising move, he left the city, leaving Jerusalem, leaving the capital to his rebellious son, and even in the process referring to Absalom as the king. On his way out of the city, though, he met several people, one of whom plays a big feature in our story this morning. His name was Hushai. We hadn't met this guy before. He's described as a friend of David's, and that word probably means some type of royal advisor or counselor, some type of official position. But he met David on the way out of the city, and David turned him around and said, "You go back into the city, and you be an advisor within the court of Absalom for my sake." Because, see, David had already found out that one of his other counselors, a guy named Ahithophel, had turned against David and was now counseling Absalom for him. So David sent Hushai back to be a spy. And that sets up the main drama in our story this morning, which will be a clash of counselors. Two different voices trying to influence Absalom, trying to decide what will happen next for David. Now, hopefully I've inundated you well with Hebrew names that you're swimming in. So we're going to do a little review to make sure we're all on the same page so we can track with our story this morning. David's son, who's trying to become king, has overthrown him. His name is Absalom, right, that's Absalom. The bad counselor, the one that used to be David's counselor, that's now counseling against David for Absalom is a little bit less confident, but yeah, Ahithophel, all right? The other A name, Ahithophel, right? That's the bad counselor. The good counselor, David's friend, who is now sent back as a spy, his name is Hushai, right. If you remember those three names, and don't forget David, then you should be set for the story. Absalom is David's son trying to become king. Ahithophel is the bad counselor. Hushai is the good voice sent back as a spy. Most of our story this morning doesn't even involve David. It's all these three men, and it's all events that transpire outside of David's control. He's in that place where he has done all he can do, and now his fate rests with someone else. It's a place that we're familiar with at various points in our lives, whether it's applying for a job like I did in high school, or asking someone out, or doing a big project and completing it and not knowing how it will be received. Maybe it's taking a week off worship and going out in our community and serving and wondering what the response will be. There comes a point in things that we do where we have to say, I've done all I can do. The only thing left to me is to wait and see how it will turn out. It's a vulnerable place to be. In that place, you are exposed. You can't do anything to protect yourself. Decisions are being made about you. And it turns out that these kinds of moments can be powerful ones in our relationship with God. When we're vulnerable in that kind of way, we are open to God in a new way. So as long as there's work to be done, as long as we can apply ourselves toward a goal, we can distract ourselves with our efforts, and we can convince ourselves that we've got it. We can handle it. But when we get to that place where there's nothing more that we can do, we have to face our own lack of control. And those times can be opportunities for us, opportunities for our faith in the God of the universe to become more than an abstract concept, opportunities for faith to be lived out in practice. It's terrifying, but it can be liberating at the same time. Let's walk with David through this vulnerable place that he finds himself in and see what we can learn about facing similar situations in our own lives. David has sent Hushai back. Hushai is going to be David's spy, but the first task of any good spy is to earn the trust of the guy that you're trying to double side, right? So Hushai has to prove to Absalom that he's trustworthy. Listen to verses 15 through 19. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. And when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" And Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend?" And Hushai said to Absalom, "No, for whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain. And again, whom should I serve? Should it not be his son? As I have served your father, so I will serve you." So Hushai makes his pitch, and it's a great example of political vagary, right? I'm going to serve the guy that everybody chooses, that the Lord wants to be on the throne. Well, is that Absalom? Is that David? As I've served your father, I'll serve you. Or maybe I'm still serving your father as I'm pretending to serve you. Hushai's made his pitch. He's trying to convince Absalom to trust him. And as readers, we're wondering, did it work? Is the spy brought into the fold? Is he accepted or not? Is he found out? And we don't find out. We're not told. His pitch hangs there. And we move on to the next counselor. Absalom realizes that now that he has the city, he has to do something to assert his role as the new king. So he asks Ahithophel, "What should I do?" Listen to verses 20 through 21. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, "Give your counsel. What shall we do?" Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened. This is a ruthless strategy, effective but brutal. To lie with his father's concubines is a powerful statement of disrespect. It's a vulgar assertion of his right to be king. And it's humiliating to his father. Of course, it was strictly against the Jewish law for a son to lie with his father's wife. But this is the act that Ahithophel says Absalom should do. And we find out what kind of guy Ahithophel is and what kind of king he would have Absalom to be. Once again, women being used sexually to further the political ambitions of the men in our story. Absalom thinks it's a great idea. He does it, and indeed, it's very successful. The chapter ends with this really over-the-top pronouncement of the kind of advice that Ahithophel gives. Listen to verse 23. Now in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed, both by David and now by Absalom. This was a guy that gave really good advice. Now for us, we see these two counselors. We're rooting for Hushai, but it doesn't look good. We don't know whether his pitch was accepted. Absalom made a brilliant, if evil, suggestion that was taken and successful, and he is regarded by everyone as an excellent counselor. And so we're worried. We're worried for David. He's in a vulnerable place. The tension is building. When have you found yourself feeling like this? Feeling like the cards might be stacked against you? Feeling like you might be vulnerable and not able to do anything about it? When are you vulnerable? A few months ago, I went down to the park to play wiffle ball with my son. I was pitching him the wiffle ball. We had one of those really big, fat plastic bats, and he was swinging at it. And after one hit, the ball kind of, you know, struck the bat on the sideways and popped up and went over the fence and went into the street, and it was rolling towards the gutter on the far side of the street. So I walked around the fence and went over, and I was walking towards the wiffle ball when a car drove by, and it stopped right at the wiffle ball. And somebody got out of the back seat, went over, picked up my wiffle ball, got in their car, and drove off. And I thought, who does that? Who steals a wiffle ball from a 9-year-old boy on the side of the street? Sometimes you don't even know when you're vulnerable. You don't know what might be taken from you. And of course, that's a silly example, and we face way more serious times of vulnerability, but sometimes they come out of nowhere. We think we're okay, and we're not. I want to invite you to consider something you might be facing right now, some place where you might be vulnerable, some way that you've put yourself out there, some risk you've taken, some thing you're waiting on, and you don't know how it's going to turn out. What do you do in that moment? It might work out. Maybe you get the job, or you get the girl, or you get the guy, or you get whatever it is. Or maybe your wiffle ball gets stolen, and you're left shocked at the state of the world. How do you wait there? It's the kind of position David's in. Decisions are being made that will completely change his life. And as the story progresses, we get to the scene where these two counselors go head to head. First, Ahithophel says what he thinks the next step should be. Here's verses 1 to 4 of chapter 17. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king, and I will bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. We know that David is vulnerable. Ahithophel knows that David is vulnerable. He wants to form a strike team, capitalize on the element of surprise, go, execute the king, and bring everybody back under Absalom's rule. It's good advice. We can see that. The elders of Israel can see that. This is the right thing to do. But Absalom wants to make sure, so he asks Hushai. Verses 5 through 8. Then Absalom said, "Call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say." And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." Then Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." Hushai said, "You know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged, like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is expert in war. He will not spend the night with the people." And Hushai goes on to try to convince Absalom to wait, to trade the element of surprise for strength, assemble a large army, and then go in a couple days and crush David and his men. Don't go quick, go big. What's going to happen? Whose advice will Absalom take? We know Ahithophel's is better. Verse 14. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." Amazingly, Absalom takes the worse advice. And we are relieved as readers of the story. David will live to fight another day. The situation is still uncertain, but at least we've avoided certain doom. In the rest of the chapter, Hushai sends spies to warn David. They nearly get caught, but they make through. And then Ahithophel realizes that there's no room around the throne for a counselor whose counsel is ignored. So he hangs himself. And all of a sudden, the tables are turned. All of a sudden, David is in a much safer place. Why? What happened? Well, it's because of God. Verse 14 makes it clear. The Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel. But why would God do this? Why does God intervene here at this moment to protect David? Well, it's because David asked. We read it 2 weeks ago, 2 Samuel 15, verse 31. And it was told David, "Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom." As soon as David learned that this guy had betrayed him, he says this. David said, "O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." It's a simple prayer, but in fact, there had been about a 10 to 12 year gap before this point where we had no evidence of David's spiritual life. No prayers, no asking God what to do, no psalms attributed to this time. And here, as he's fleeing Jerusalem, he stops and he worships and he prays. He asks God to protect him. And God does. God comes through. We don't actually see what David is experiencing in the midst of this while these events are going on around him. In a few minutes, we'll look at a psalm that gives us a little more of a picture about what he might have been feeling. But we might ask of ourselves, what do we do in that kind of moment? How do we handle that vulnerability? Think again about that situation that you might be facing. Can you trust God in that? Can you trust God when you're vulnerable? As is often the case, we can fall off the cliff on both sides. On the one hand, we can become withdrawn. We can pull back. We can be overwhelmed by the complexity of our situation. We can't do anything, so we're just going to curl up in a ball, go fetal, rock ourselves, and hope the world is kind to us, right? We just escape because it's so terrifying. On the other hand, and this is probably what more of us are inclined to do, we can get into hyper-controlling mode. We can try to find something we can do to convince ourselves that we can have an impact on the situation. It might seem to be out of our control, but if we just send one more email, or just one more phone call, or if I just do this, if I just lobby my case, if I just do something, then I can at least feel, at least have the illusion that I'm still in control. But what if we do neither of those things? What if we just accept the fact that we're vulnerable? And we ask God to protect us. Not hiding it, not distracting ourselves, but just being there in that moment. Here's what we need to know. We can trust God when we're vulnerable. We can go to Him. We can ask Him. He will protect us. Doesn't mean we won't get hurt. Doesn't mean it'll always turn out the way we want it to turn out. But we can even trust God when we do get hurt. We know that God is good, that He will have our back. What do you do when you're vulnerable? Do you withdraw? Do you become controlling? How do you trust in that place? God gave David this little victory, this preference for Hushai's advice in that moment. But David is not out of danger yet. The battle is still coming. He still has to fight his son. And so God gives him something else in the midst of waiting. He gives him this surprise moment of refreshment. See, David arrives at a city as he flees Jerusalem called Mahanaim. Now, this city actually appeared early in our story. If you remember the time when David was king over part of Israel, and there was another guy, Saul's son, named Ishbosheth, who was king over the other part of Israel. Well, Ishbosheth made his headquarters in a city called Mahanaim. That time is long gone, but now David is fleeing Jerusalem. He arrives at that city, and he would not expect to receive a warm welcome there. This was the headquarters of his rival from years past, so he would be anxious about how people might treat him when he arrives there. And that's why it's so surprising what does happen. Listen to verses 27 through 29. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi the son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir the son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought beds, basins, and earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds and sheep and cheese from the herd for David and the people with him to eat. For they said, "The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." This is an incredible welcome. People coming from all over, bringing all sorts of food and provisions, empathizing with David in his hunger and weariness and refreshing him and his men. It's not what David would have expected. It's not something he could have manufactured. All he can do is receive it. I find myself growing more and more grateful for moments like this. Those times when you aren't trying to make something happen, but God just drops something in your lap. So much of the time I have a goal, I have a project, I have something I'm trying to accomplish, and I'm working toward it. And it's great when it comes through, but then these things happen. A compliment on a discouraging day, or an email from an old friend, or somebody showing up with a gift you didn't expect. And you realize, I didn't do this. I didn't make this. All I can do is receive it. That's what David receives. And it's incredibly important because the battle keeps going. Every little challenge leads to some new challenge that faces on the other side. It's one thing to trust God for one big heroic push, but it's another thing to trust God day in, day out, through all the little things, through all the projects that just keep on going. Can you trust God over the long haul? Can you wait for those surprise gifts from God that you can't control, but that will come nonetheless? Can you keep going? You know that feeling It's a big project. You've spent yourself. You've focused on it. Everything leads up to it. You get through the project, and it's the next morning, and you want to just retire, right? Be done. You want to, all right, I'm out. Mic drop. But life doesn't work that way. There's another project. There's something else to face. Beautiful day is over, but next year is only a year away, right? This is the way life is. We're never done. We're never at rest. And life in the Silicon Valley has a way of just grinding you. You sprint and you think, all right, I can make it to the end of the week. And you get to the end of the week, and then what happens? Another week starts. And you got to sprint again. We have to cultivate this kind of faith that persists, that continues, that finds a rhythm where we can trust God regularly. Because what if those big moments, those big projects, what if the trusting in those moments isn't the real important thing? What if the real thing is that regular daily response? What if we're always vulnerable? What if we're in that place for moments so that we can learn to live in that place? We've completed this big push with Beautiful Day to serve our community, but the point is not for one weekend. The point is to develop lives of service, to form our characters and our hearts for the sake of our community. God is doing something bigger than one big moment. And when we cultivate that kind of faith, God provides. He surprises us with things that we can't control. He gives us gifts, and all we can do is receive them and say thank you. Well, the story in 2 Samuel has focused on events outside of David's control. We've seen the stuff swirling around him, but we haven't gotten a picture of what it's been like for David. What has he felt in these moments? And so for that, I want to turn to Psalm 3. Several of the Psalms are attributed to certain periods in David's life, and Psalm 3 is attributed to the time when David was on the run from Absalom. And when we read this psalm with the story from 2 Samuel in the background, we get a deeper sense of what might have been going on. Listen to how these words unfold. Here's Psalm 3, verse 1 to 2. O Lord, how many are my foes! Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God. Selah. It doesn't look good. Even David's own son is trying to kill him. The forces of Israel have turned against him. Everybody's saying, not even God can help this guy. So what does David do? How does he respond? Verse 5 and 6, I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. That's an incredible picture. In the midst of this stress, in the midst of being vulnerable, what does David do? He accepts his vulnerability. He makes himself more vulnerable. He lies down and he sleeps, trusting God. I was going to have this be one of our applications. Can you sleep? But I was worried that you already would have been. And you'd say, yeah, actually, I'm doing fine on that account. But can you imagine that? Lying down and sleeping as your enemies surround you. Because David does that, then the psalm culminates with this grand statement in verse 8, salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people, Selah. David did all he could. He lay down and slept. He trusted God. And now that salvation came, all he can do is attribute it to God. You did this. Thank you, God. All I can do is receive. Well, for the past several weeks, we've been thinking particularly about engaging our culture. From Palm Sunday through Easter, proclaiming the resurrection of Christ, to fostering and Beautiful Day, we've been thinking about how do we as the church get out there? How do we impact our culture? It seems to be a movement of God in our midst, trying to help us to get out there. We're actually probably planning on doing a series in the fall that's going to focus on the book of Acts, trying to help us think about what it looks like for us to come from in here to go out there. But it's a risky proposition. We can do certain things and God calls us to be faithful, but then it's out of our hands. And honestly, it doesn't look good. The polls don't make faith in Silicon Valley a popular thing. People are not drawn to God in droves. They're leaving the church. They're skeptical of God. They're unsure of faith. So what do? We pray. And we keep praying. And we ask God for his spirit to move in our communities, in our lives, in our neighborhoods. We want to see God at work. And the truth is that he is. We've seen glimmers. And so we continue in faith, trusting that it's not something we can force, it's not something we can manipulate. It is the work of God in our area. And we can ask for it and then receive it. Receive those gifts as God moves. We will see God's blessing poured out on his people. Well, if you remember that picture of me waiting by the phone, waiting for Charles Prince to call me, you'll be pleased to know that I got the job. It was a good job. I was selling rollerblades for the summer, and I learned what any good salesman needs to learn, how to sound knowledgeable about things of which you have no idea. And of course, as life kind of continued, I was given more and more opportunities to trust God in moments of deeper and deeper vulnerability, because that's just the way life is. But what I've learned along the way, and what's been surprising to me, is who's right by my side, trusting in vulnerability with me. Corey Gustafson hosted an event this past week, bringing in a speaker for the women's ministry on the religion of Islam. She was kind enough to invite several other people to come and kind of hide in the back and try not to disrupt the vibe of women's ministry. So I was a male invader for the moment, but this woman gave a phenomenal presentation, and what I was struck by is her respect and admiration even, and fair-handedness with dealing with another faith, saying that this is not evil, that there are some beautiful aspects to this, not resorting to prejudice or bad-mouthing, but at the same time drawing a clear distinction that what we believe and what the Bible teaches about our God and about Jesus is markedly different. And in particular, I was struck by this fact that our God, the God that is revealed in these pages, makes himself vulnerable. That he becomes incarnate. That he subjects himself, even though he's all powerful, to pain and rejection and loss. So much so that at the end of his life, Jesus himself is saying, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." Even the Son of God finds himself in that place where he's done all he can do, and his fate is in the hands of others. How are you vulnerable today? Can you trust God with it? Can you sleep even in that moment? If you do, you're in good company. Jesus himself is there with you, accepting his own vulnerability, going to the Father with it, and in the process, teaching us how to have faith and encouraging us along the way, so that we can proclaim with David these words from Psalm 3, verses 3 to 4. "But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill." Amen.